Brown's actions. Now, on the phone right now, we have a gentleman, Brad Friedman of bradblog.com. Good evening, sir.
Hey, Bob. How are you? Sorry about the confusion.
Oh, that's okay. That's all okay. Let me just give a little bit of an introduction, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Mr. Friedman is a whale of a good blogger and has focused in particular or with particular emphasis on the election irregularities issue. Fair statement?
Yeah, fair enough, whether I like it or not. Yeah.
Some are born to greatness, and others have greatness thrust upon them.
There you go.
And in particular, you've been following recently the opening of the Baker-Carter Election Commission, right?
Yes, sir.
That happened yesterday.
Yes, it did.
Not exactly impressive.
Well, let's put it this way. The commission is cooked from top to bottom. It starts, of course, with the fact that you've got Jim Baker sitting at the top of this commission as co-chair. Jim Baker, the man who assured that votes would not be counted in the 2000 election,
right,
America's votes would not be counted, is now leading a commission on how to improve inclusion in the electoral process in American democracy. It almost, it kind of blows your mind when you think about it.
Why in heaven's name do you think a decent soul like Jimmy Carter would lend his credibility to this sham?
You know, it's very hard to figure out because, in fact, this commission was formed in secret, and none of us knew about it. I actually co-founded, since I've been reporting on all these election irregularities, an organization called VelvetRevolution.us, which comprises almost 100 real election reform and voting rights groups. None of us knew anything about this commission. None of us were even asked to testify or be on it or anything else. And, you know, the entire thing seems to have been so gamed, really, that, you know, there's no way of telling how it came about, why Jimmy Carter would agree to be on it. And we know that, in fact, Baker and a lot of his compatriots at his law firm who were also involved in the 2000 fiasco,
that would be
as
Baker.
Well as voting machine companies were actually representatives from voting machine companies are on the commission.
Oh, that's nice.
I mean, the entire thing is so bizarre, so I can't tell you why Jimmy Carter would play along with this.
Well, there was an opening salvo yesterday, or was it today? Was it yesterday?
Which salvo?
I'm thinking about John Fund.
Yeah.
Now, for people who don't know, John Fund is a former writer, editorialist, or of some sort with the Wall Street Journal, correct?
Are you sure it's former?
Yeah, I was hoping it was. Maybe it's not former. What I know him as is a serial woman beater.
Well, really?
Yeah, yeah. The John Fund is a real beauty.
Okay.
He has regaled the world with right-wing moral high ground garbage, and then you know, like to smack the girlfriend around a little bit.
Well, I don't know about that. I'll let you stand by that one.
Okay.
Not to say it didn't happen. I just don't know anything about it.
Yeah, and
but
that's
I do know,
past his prologue. But what he did.
Well, indeed. And I do know that he is now, of course, a regular contributor to the Fox News Channel, where he was speaking with Brett Hume last night about what he had to say at these hearings. Essentially, the hearings really made a mockery of the election reform movement and of all the election irregularities that have been documented, and there have been thousands since November. Almost all the folks who testified yesterday managed to change the idea of election reform. Somehow that all morphed into voter fraud, voter registration fraud, and in John Fund's case, he was even talking about provisional voter fraud for provisional folks who cast provisional ballots.
Mm-hmm. And the part that just jumped screaming off the page at me when I read your site, Brad, was the line about in dealing with the provisional ballots, how poll workers should be able to tell. What's the exact line?
Actually, I have it here. It's pretty amazing. Well, because what they did was they tried to get. Everyone was talking about photo ID, you know, they all suggests that there's all this epidemic of voter fraud, none of which has been documented, mind you, but that's become the problem. So in Fund's case, he said, I think we could prevent possible provisional voting fraud if we keep the provisional voting as much as possible in the precinct where in which the voter is assigned, because the election officials are more likely to know whether they can allow the person's, whether the residence is a real residence and whether or not the person, here we go, looks as if they belong in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
You decide what that means and how the poll workers...
What's that black person doing here? What I read.
There you go.
Really,
that's what this photo ID business is about, because my understanding is that some 10% of the electorate does not have photo IDs because they, and as it turns out, they're in minority areas, big cities that tend to vote Democratic because, you know, for example, in Manhattan, you know, how many people have driver's license that live in Manhattan?
Right. Who needs one?
Right. So this nonsense about photo ID, I'm almost loath to even discuss it because it plays on, it allows them to set the agenda and allows some phony straw man argument about whether photo ID is needed when in fact there is no epidemic of voter fraud. What we have, however, is thousands and thousands of cases and incidents of voters being disenfranchised, voters not being able to vote, thousands of votes appearing on electronic voting machines out of nowhere, thousands of votes disappearing on electronic machines. Those are the real problems that we need to talk about.
Well, sure, and people being, when you talk about disenfranchisement, we talked about it during the election cycle, and I had people who were calling this show and were incredulous and frankly thought I was making it up, that there might be, say, a polling place where three or four different precincts were contained in the same room.
Right.
And if you cast your vote, say, you know, you're supposed to vote at Precinct 3, and you go to the Precinct 41 machine,
yep,
you just got disenfranchised.
Yep. And that happened in Ohio. Mind you, in Ohio, had 60,000 votes been recorded for Kerry instead of George Bush, you know, out of, I think it's 8 million or something votes in Ohio, out of that number, had 60,000 gone for Kerry instead of Bush, Kerry would be the president now. Yet thousands of votes were thrown away, provisional ballots were thrown away, because the voter would put the provisional ballot at the wrong table in the right building, because, as you said, there was, you know, three or four different precincts in the same building, and those votes were all summarily thrown out, never counted, and, you know, voters had no idea because the poll workers didn't even know to explain to these people. They were not trained to say, hey, you have to put it in the right bucket.
Well, I guess there are some who would say that we're talking about some sort of conspiracy theory, Brad. I don't think that is where we're going. These are documented incidents.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's not a conspiracy theory that in the Gahanna 1B precinct in Ohio, in Franklin County, where 637 voters voted that day. Out of those 637 voters, how many votes do you imagine George W. Bush received?
Was this the place where he got 6,000 votes?
Yeah, over 4,000 votes, George W. Bush, out of 630 that were cast.
Yeah.
And that was not discovered by election officials or the media. That was actually discovered by folks like myself, internet bloggers, folks who were poring over the numbers saying, wait, something's not right here because these numbers do not match up with the exit polls, which are always right everywhere else but America, including in the Ukraine, when the same company, it was actually the Mitofsky Edison company that ran the polls in the Ukraine, they came out and said that the challenger should have won, according to the exit polls, but the final results showed showed the incumbent winning. Well, in that case, when that happened, George Bush and Colin Powell came out and said, well, look, it's fraud. It's clearly shown by the exit polls not matching up with the final results. The same damn thing happened in America and by the same company, and yet in that case it was a problem. The exit polls were wrong, not the final results, inexplicably, and frankly the corporate media turned the other way and didn't bother to report any of these any of these numbers that so many of us have now, an increasingly large movement, are yelling and screaming about and saying, hey, look, guys, pay attention to the franchise. Pay attention to the democracy. These are not conspiracy theories. These are documented, provable, confirmable pieces of evidence, you know, that you can check with the boards of election.
Brad, we've got to go to our top of the hour news break.
Yeah.
Can you stay with us? I'd like to move this a little bit into a question. I'd like you to explain to people a little bit about Clint Curtis.
Okay.
Can you hang with us?
I'd be happy to.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Exactly.
We'll be back to you. We're talking with Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com. He has been tireless in trying to sort out to call them election irregularities is to use a form of English that's almost too mild. We're talking about election fraud here, the verified real election fraud. Look here, it's happened again. Oh, it's Florida all over. Yeah, it is. So we're going to take our top of the hour news break from ABC, and then we'll come back and talk some more with Brad Friedman. You're listening to News Talk 620 WWNR. This is Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid.
WWNR, Beckley.
It's your second hour in the liberal sandbox, and you're Head On with Bob Kincaid.
Welcome back. 6 minutes after 8 o'clock, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is Head On, and we're chatting with Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com, a voting fraud specialist by any definition of the term. I think it's fair to say, given the investigative hours that he's put into what used to be our ostensibly free and fair election process. You still with us, Brad?
I am indeed.
You mentioned, before we went to the break, you mentioned hating to go into an issue because it was almost like allowing them to set the terms of the debate, to frame the debate. And I think in large part, part and parcel of this problem is that we've already done that insofar as every election debate that I run across or discussion focuses on which corporate-controlled election company we're going to allow to build the machines, make the machines, install the machines, as opposed to the fundamental debate of why are we doing this? Is that fair?
Right. I mean, make no mistake. The good guys in this fight are definitely playing catch-up constantly. I mean, when the Baker-Carter Commission we were talking about in the last hour was sort of announced out of nowhere, you know, that it was already set in stone. They had the guys who were going to sit on top of that, and they were voting machine representatives and everything else. And, you know, now it's a matter of guys like me trying to play catch up. We did, however, catch them a little bit earlier than usual this time because of some reporting I did on this phony voting rights group called the American Center of Voting Rights that claimed to be a nonpartisan group. They came out of nowhere on March 17th. 3 days later, they testified before a U.S. congressional hearing. 3 days after they, you know, anybody had ever heard about them at all. And in fact, they are comprised of the National General Counsel for Bush Cheney 04 Inc.
How do you like
that?
And
the Communications Director for the RNC. So we, however, did catch that time coming out of the box. But you're right. With these voting machine companies, they're all controlled by hard right partisans. And the question of whether we should have them at all is, if it was up to me, we wouldn't. We'd have paper and pencil. But the
Thank
fact
you.
Of the matter is that millions of dollars has now been set aside to go to these companies via the Help America Vote Act. And what I'm trying to help get done at VelvetRevolution.us, an organization I helped co-found, is at least if we're going to be voting on these machines, let's ensure that there's a paper ballot created with every vote cast, and that the hardware and software is opened up for inspection, not proprietary. Right now it's proprietary, and when you go to vote on an electronic voting machine, you may as well tell me who you want to vote for, and I will go in and in secret record your vote, and you'll simply trust that I'll do it accurately. That's what we're asked to do every time we vote with an electronic voting machine, because we have no idea, no clue whether our votes are being counted accurately.
Well, Brad, you mentioned paper and pencil or pen, and that made me, that just overjoyed me.
Yeah.
Because, among other things, now, here in West Virginia, in the last election cycle, oddly enough, the first county to have its all precincts counted and its returns to the state capitol was the lone county, oddly enough, that still uses paper ballots.
They were the first ones to have their returns?
They were the first ones with their returns in. Their returns were the most accurate.
My understanding is up in Canada, and I don't know Canada's system as well as I know America's, but my understanding is they use all paper and pencil, and their voting returns are in within 45 minutes after the polls close. So it can be done, but you know the system that we're dealing with. You know that it's all about money right now, and that millions of dollars goes to the politicians from these voting companies. And that in return, the thanks they get is even more millions go back to the voting companies through this legislation. And it's like a tsunami, frankly, trying to hold it back. So at velvetrevolution.us, we are trying at least to fight the fights that we believe we can win. It's almost, for the moment, I think, impossible to stop these the avalanche of these voting machine of these voting machines. So if they're going to be there, I think we can all agree, if you have to use them, at least let's make them verifiable and accountable. You know, wasn't it Reagan who said trust but verify?
Oh yes, I remember that well.
We would like to verify that our votes are counted accurately. I mean, hell, it's only democracy we're talking about. It's only the most important element of democracy that we're talking about, which is the vote.
Well, you talk about picking your fights, and I certainly understand that philosophy, Brad. Is there a difference between, say, the national fight and, say, things that people can do on a local level? Are there localized things that people can do?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are things that folks can do everywhere, and I got to tell you, I am probably the perfect example of one voice that does make a difference. I've been making a lot of noise, as you've noticed, as you've pointed out, and frankly, I'm not an activist. I'm not a journalist. I'm just a guy. I'm a guy with a blog. I'm a citizen, you know?
Yeah.
And I have no business being in the middle of the stuff that I'm in the middle of, but I was willing to look around, you know, see these extraordinary things and write about them on the blog and make noise about them. And I would encourage your listeners, you know, when you hear, for example, we're pointing folks towards velvetrevolution.us where they can send email to the Baker Carter Commission demanding Baker steps down, where we demand that the voting machine companies open up their hardware and software and include paper ballots. When you hear that, go do it. Go send those emails. Trust me, it drives those folks crazy to get avalanches of emails from people. So you can do that. You can write letters to your editor, to your local newspaper. Pay attention what is going on the local level, you know, on your local election boards. Volunteer to be election workers. Those things really do make a difference, and I think that a lot of Americans out there feel like, I'm just one guy, there's nothing I can do that will make a difference. It does make a difference, and, you know, the bad guys win when you decide that that it doesn't make a difference, when you don't do anything.
Now,
do something, make noise.
Exactly. There are, I've been following this since 2000, and there is something that you hit on some time back, like I said, during the previous election cycle. There is a reason to worry about these machines, and that was a lot of that was brought forward in your exclusive exposure of the assertions of one Clint Curtis. Can you share that story with us, Brad?
Sure. I'm speaking of one guy, one voice that can make a difference, and Clint Curtis has been trying yelling and screaming about his story for about 4 years, and finally it's seems like we're starting to get some traction to get the news out there of what happens, what happened, what he claims in a sworn affidavit happened, what he testified in sworn testimony before members of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee happened. It's on video. It's at bradblog.com. You can check it out. Essentially, Curtis's story is that he was working at a software firm down in Oviedo, Florida, back in 2000 by the name of Yang Enterprises, Inc. At the time, Yang's corporate counsel and registered lobbyist was a man by the name of Tom Feeney. Well, Tom Feeney also happened to be the Speaker of the Florida House, and your listeners may recall him from 2000. He's the fellow who said that he didn't care what the Supreme Court did during that election in the mess of 2000. He was going to make sure that Florida's electors went to George W. Bush. Feeney is also was the running mate to Jeb Bush when Jeb first ran for governor back in 94. So he's closely tied to the Bushes, and now Feeney sits on the U.S. Congress in the U.S. House Judiciary Committee. Basically, what Curtis claims is that Feeney came to the company where Feeney was working and asked him to create what essentially was a vote-rigging software prototype. He was very specific what he wanted. He wanted he had to have three things. It had to be usable on touchscreen machines. It had to not require any additional equipment like a keyboard, et cetera. And it had to be the routines had to be hidden in the source code. They had to be invisible so that when folks looked at the source code, they would not see these vote flipping routines.
Okay,
now,
explain vote flipping, please.
Yeah, well, what he was asking him to do, and essentially Clint Curtis is a Republican, was a Republican at the time, as was Feeney, and gave the impression that he was concerned that Democrats would try to rig the vote with these electronic machines, and that he wanted to see how they might do it so they would know what to look out for, essentially. Well, so the program that he was asking was to him to create was essentially something that you could touch some buttons on the screen, and if the candidate you wanted to win was already winning, then it essentially wouldn't do anything. But if the candidate you wanted to lose was ahead, then what it would do is it would flip the votes. It would give 51% to your candidate and 49% to all of the other candidates, and it would essentially be divided up in the same proportion that all the other candidates had before the flip occurred.
Okay.
So he went away. He went to build this program at the company, came back the next day. It was a very simple program. I mean, it's quite easy. You know, we're talking about voting programs, essentially, you know, add one plus one. It's
yeah.
Not all that complicated. He came back with a program that would do exactly this, gave it to his CEO of the company, Mrs. Yang, on a CD, and said, look, I was able to do everything you wanted, except I can't hide the vote flipping routines in the software. If anybody is to examine the source code for the software, they will see these routines. And the CEO said to him at the time, well, Mrs. Yang said to him, you don't understand. In order to get the contract, we have to hide the routines in the source code. This program is needed to control the vote in South Florida.
God. Just told him.
Yes, sir.
This is... We're fixing the election now. Within a time frame, when are we talking about, Brad?
Well, this was just prior to the meeting took place. I believe it was either late September or early October, according to Curtis's affidavit, of 2000. So it was just prior to the 2000 election.
And when he delivered the CD to Mrs. Yang, what did Mrs. Yang do with it?
At that point, we don't know. All he knows is Curtis gave it to her, and she, you know, took it. She was disappointed that he couldn't hide the source code and the routines of the source code, and away it went, presumably to be delivered to Tom Feeney, but Curtis doesn't know, of course, whether it was or wasn't.
Now, Yang Enterprises went on to have their own problems, didn't they?
Well, yeah. As a matter of fact, Clint Curtis left the company because of that meeting, which made him very uncomfortable, and others like it, where he was seeing illegal Chinese aliens working at this company, inserting wiretapping modules into top secret software that they had contracts with NASA. They still have contracts with NASA, by the way. And he went away and eventually got a new job at the Florida Department of Transportation, found that Yang was overbilling the Florida Department of Transportation because they had a contract there. He went and reported all of these things to the Inspector General's office at the DOT in Florida, talked about the illegal aliens, which would be against the contract for them to, you know, to have an illegal alien working on a DOT contract. He reported that. He reported the overbilling and so forth. And in fact, some, I'd say 80, 85, 90% of the claims that he had made at the time back in 2001 have since been borne out. That illegal alien, a fellow by the name of Hai Lin Ni, Henry Ni, was in fact charged with, was arrested after a four-year sting by Homeland Security Department, charged with three counts of attempting to send Hellfire anti-tank missile chips to China.
Oh, how nice.
Yeah, and in fact, he pled guilty to one of those charges, and in the plea agreements, and again, I have, you know, the court documents, and, you know, I work from evidence, not from speculation.
Right.
I have the court documents up and online, and Ni is quoted in the plea agreement as saying, it was a slow year, so we only did this 10 to 20 times in the last year. Now, he pled guilty in October of 2004, and for these charges, Mr. Ni was sentenced, get ready, to 3 years probation and a $100 fine.
Did we send him home?
No, sir. He still lives in Oviedo, Florida.
Ow.
And he's still illegal. He's been an illegal alien since January 1 of 2000.
Now, you talk about working from evidence, Brad.
Yeah.
Is there any other reasonable interpretation than that this is just pure dirt? I mean, this is just filthy business from top to bottom. Is there some way of saying, well, this is a misunderstanding?
Well,
have you found that?
Well, I'll tell you what Tom Feeney said, who, as I say, now sits on the U.S. House Judiciary Committee. What Tom Feeney and Yang and their attorneys all say is that Clint Curtis is completely full of it, that he's a liar, that he has no proof for these election rigging charges that he's talking about. And indeed, we're still digging and trying to find proof because right now it's sort of a he said situation. There were other people in that meeting, but none of those people, one of them was Mrs. Yang, the CEO, none of them are willing to talk. Mrs. Yang's executive secretary, Mike Cohen, won't talk. And in fact, after years at the Yang company, he's now been, and as he was the spokesman, as a matter of fact, if you went to their website, it said, you know, for information, call Mike Cohen. He's been moved out of the headquarters and sort of buried out at NASA where you can't get in touch with him. He won't talk about what's going on. They all deny. They all say Curtis is a liar, but guess what? Last month, Clint Curtis took a polygraph test and apparently passed with flying colors, as reported in the St. Petersburg Times.
But, you know, interestingly, and this we talk a little bit on this show, Brad, about the so-called liberal media.
Right. What liberal media?
Yeah, it doesn't exist. Now, is it just because we didn't happen to be watching that Friday night when this was all over NBC and ABC and CBS and the rest of the alphabet soup? I mean, this has been covered in detail, right?
No, sir. Not only was it not on ABC, NBC, CBS, it has hardly been anywhere. Now, when I reported this story originally on December 6, 2004, I got calls from, you know, everyone from New York Times to 60 Minutes to Newsweek and everybody else. They were interested in this explosive story. They talked to Clint, and, I guess we're still waiting for their reports on it to come out. And I can't explain it. I have some theories about why it hasn't been covered in the mainstream, and it sort of came about not long after the Dan Rathergate business, and I think that put a chill on a lot of folks.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a very aggressive group of folks. As a matter of fact, some of the papers that have reported it, Seminole Chronicle, Tom Feeney's hometown paper, reported it, and what they basically reported was what was in Curtis's affidavit and what was in his testimony to U.S. House Judiciary Committee, this was a lawsuit threat from Feeney. And then in the next week, they received identical threat, almost virtually identical threat of a lawsuit from Yang's attorneys, who, by the way, of course, Yang's attorneys used to be Feeney's old law partner.
Right.
So they were threatened with a lawsuit simply for reporting what happened, which, and then you have to question, well, why has Feeney never threatened to sue Clint Curtis himself? He is the one, after all, making these charges if they're untrue.
Well, if he's a lawyer, he understands that truth is an absolute defense in a case like that.
Right.
And so I think it suffice to say that those suits have not been filed?
Those suits have not been filed. Curtis has never been threatened with a suit because, in fact, I think Curtis would welcome it and the process of discovery that would come along with it and the information that Yang and Feeney and everyone else would have to come out. I think there's nothing more that Curtis would like than to have Tom Feeney under oath in a deposition where he's got to answer to some of these questions.
Has he demonstrated any ability, and I mean this is an open-ended question,
yeah.
Has he demonstrated any ability to recreate the program as he created it for Yang?
Yeah, actually he did, and he created what is essentially a mock-up. I think he's got it up at a website of his, justaflyonthewall.com. And he has demonstrated it to folks and how it works and how simple it would be to do something like this. You know, a lot of folks have said, well, if he really made this program, why didn't he take a copy with him? If he, you know, was uncomfortable, felt it was illegal, why didn't he take a copy with him? Well, in fact, anyone who's ever worked at a company like that, it's a secure building with top secret, you know, secure contracts. You do not leave the building with software that you created on.
You can't get out of one of those buildings with a Twinkie they don't want you to leave with.
Exactly. So, but he has recreated the program. It's, you know, really kind of a no-brainer. I mean, I think there's about 24 lines of code total that are required to flip the votes the way that he did. You could see it. And, you know, mind you, he's willing to talk about it. He's, talks to really any media who wants to hear from him. I'm sure he'd be, thrilled to come on your show if you want to give him some tough questions. I can't tell you right now, as I say, whether those voting charges are absolutely true. But what I can tell you is when I started reporting this story, it was so explosive. I had, guys from, you know, from the right and from the media and everywhere else said, look, Brad, if one piece of his story is proven untrue, then you have to discount the rest of the story. And I thought, well, okay, I'm not sure about that, but I'll play by those rules if you insist. Since I reported this originally 6 months ago, I have yet to be able to find a hole in his story. As I said, more things have proven true than not. Nothing has proven untrue. About 85% of it has been proven true, whereas every time Tom Feeney or Yang, or their attorneys open their mouth, they say something that is demonstrably untrue. Yang, for example, is still insisting that Henry Nee, or Henry the Spy, as Clint Curtis calls him,
right,
never worked at their company. Now, when they first said that, I went ahead and posted over at bradblog.com the several weekly time reports on Yang stationery that were submitted to Florida Department of Transportation, signed by Henry Nee, showing, in fact, that Nee worked there 40 to 60 hours a week. A report by the Florida Inspector General's office just came out in February, of course, confirming that Nee did work there and confirming, in fact, that he was an illegal alien. So, I mean, everything they say has been has proven to be demonstrably untrue, not everything, but so many things, and I just wonder, does that same standard apply to them?
No.
Folks were suggesting I had to apply to Clint Curtis. If one part of their story is untrue, does that mean they're lying in all other respects?
No, that only applies to our side.
What's that?
That only applies to our side.
Yeah, there you go. It only applies to one side. The standards are not the same.
The sauce is for the goose and not for the gander.
Indeed. I don't know if you have time here. I could toss in one other bizarre element of the story that will blow you away about Lemmy, the Inspector General to whom Clint Curtis first went with these charges.
Can you hold through one more break?
You bet.
Okay. Brad, I'm really enjoying this. I hope we're not taking up too much of your time, because I know you're trying to get the story out as much as you possibly can.
I'm thrilled to have it get out there any way we can.
Okay. Well, hold through this break, and we'll come back. Thanks again.
You bet.
We're talking with Brad Friedman of bradblog.com, telling... I mean, this is wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning in a cold sweat stuff. This is the gun to the head of democracy that we're dealing with right now. And, you know, go look for yourself. Go to velvetrevolution.us. Go to bradblog.com. Read this stuff. You're hearing it from the author, from the person who's done the investigating. See it with your own eyes. Get all Doubting Thomas about it. Brad's not afraid for you to do that. Go ahead. Go look at Clint Curtis's website, justaflyonthewall.com, and see if you come away comfortable. In the meantime, we've got to take our bottom of the hour break, a little news update from Carl Mack, followed by Jim Hightower's nightly commentary. Then we'll come back and carry on with this. This is News Talk 620, WWNR. This is Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Head On.
Good evening, this is Carl Mack, WWNR News. Discount retailer Target Corporation will no longer allow unfettered access to cold medicines that are used to make the illegal stimulant methamphetamine. Target stores nationwide will pull many cold, allergy, and cough remedies from the shelf and sell them only from pharmacy counters. The restrictions apply to all over-the-counter drugs containing pseudoephedrine, including children's medicine, tablets, liquids, and gel caps. A number of states are following the example of Oklahoma, where restrictions on sales of some cold medicines were followed by a dramatic drop in the number of meth lab seizures. A bill that passed the legislature this month would restrict customers to 3 packages a month of the dozen or so cold medicines that are using pseudoephedrine as a solo active ingredient. State regulators have stopped issuing new consent orders and settlement agreements while the State Department of Environmental Protection reviews the way it handles them. DEP spokeswoman Jessica Greathouse says agency secretary Stephanie Timmermeyer was concerned that environmental violations were not being handled consistently across the agency's various divisions. The DEP often settles cases by working out deals for companies to fix environmental problems and pay negotiated fines. Massey Energy has completed construction of a primary care medical center in Madison. The coal operator has leased the facility to an independent physician group, which opened it on April 11th. The facility is being operated as the West Virginia Family Wellness Center. Once fully staffed, it will be available to all residents of the Boone County community of Madison. And Charleston is the test site for a U.S. Army 3-year reserve enlistment option. Recruits who choose that option will serve 3 years in a selected reserve troop program unit and the remainder of their 8-year military obligation in the individual ready reserve. For this evening, partly cloudy, mid-60s now. For tonight, partly cloudy, upper 40s to around 50. Tomorrow, same weather pattern, partly sunny, a little bit more humid tomorrow. Temperatures low to mid-70s. For News Talk 620, this is Carl Mack, when you need to know.
Friday, April 29th, a who's who of leadership training comes together for the Maximum Impact Simulcast, the most powerful leadership event of 2005. Hall of Fame coach Mike Krzyzewski, motivational expert Brian Tracy, Florida State head football coach Bobby Bowden, best-selling authors Patrick Lencioni, Michael Gerber, Marcus Buckingham, and John Maxwell, America's foremost authority on leadership. Don't miss this unforgettable day of leadership development. Friday, April 29th.
Coming to the Raleigh County Armory Civic Center. For tickets, call 255-4600.
Well, well, George W. is getting a political comeuppance and is coming from a place he least expected, conservatives. At issue is his enthusiasm for the liberty-busting USA Patriot Act, a little shop of autocratic horrors that the Bushites rammed through Congress under cover of the 9/11 terrorist attack. Several of its most intrusive anti-democratic provisions expired this year, and Bush has made their renewal a top priority. These provisions include sneak and peek secret searches by the FBI of people's homes and computers, the secret raiding of libraries and medical offices to grab people's records, and a definition of terrorist that is so broad that it includes citizens who simply protest government policy. Fortunately for America, there are some real conservatives who balk at such a dangerous extension of autocratic police power, even if it's imposed by Bushite Republicans masquerading as conservatives. Libertarian-minded Republicans such as Bob Barr, Paul Weyrich, and Grover Norquist have now joined such liberal advocates for liberty as the ACLU in an Oddfellow coalition to battle the Bushites. Called Patriots to Restore Checks and Balances, the coalition is rallying grassroots opposition to the renewal of the most offensive parts of the perversely named Patriot Act. The grassroots need little rallying, however, for they're already on the move. Montana, for example, is in the forefront of a red state rebellion against Bush's intrusive police powers. Montana lawmakers have overwhelmingly approved a strong resolution criticizing Bush's Patriot Act, uniting Republican legislators with Democrats. Civil liberties are a bipartisan issue in Montana, said a Republican state representative who led the House effort to pass the resolution by a vote of 88-12. This is Jim Hightower saying, we can't take liberty for granted. To fight the Bushites' grab for more police power, call the coalition, 1-800-583-9122.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac. The libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what. Support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library, so make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
WWNR Beckley.
A guy who's in no rush to be savage, Bob Kincaid.
Welcome back. 23 minutes before 9 o'clock here at News Talk 620. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is Head On. An ongoing conversation with Brad Friedman of bradblog.com and velvetrevolution.us about voting irregularities that he has investigated and uncovered, reaching back to before the 2000 election. Brad, thanks for staying with us.
You betcha.
You were going to add another link to this sordid little chain when we had to take our break.
Yeah, well, on this Clint Curtis story, just to catch folks up a bit, the software programmer who claims that he was asked by U.S. Congressman Tom Feeney to create vote rigging software, he went with these claims to the Florida Inspector General's office after he left Yang Enterprises, Inc., where Feeney was the corporate counsel and registered lobbyist, even while he was the Florida Speaker of the House. No conflict there.
No.
So he reported this, all of this and the Chinese spies and the overbilling that Yang was doing from his contract to the Florida, the Inspector General at the Florida Department of Transportation, a fellow by the name of Raymond Lemmy. That was in May of 2001. A few months later, Clint Curtis and another whistleblower at the Florida Department of Transportation, who also filed complaints about Yang's overbilling, they were both summarily fired without explanation on the same day. They both filed whistleblower suits and essentially won, but Curtis nonetheless was not able to get his job back because his paperwork was filed a day late or something like that.
Yeah.
And you move the ball now 2 years down the road to mid-June 2003. Clint Curtis is now working at a 99-cent store down in Florida. He has Raymond Lemmy, the Inspector General guy, has been working on the case all of this time, talking to Curtis periodically, asking him questions and updating him on the progress of the report. Comes into the store and tells him, well, guess what? You're going to be very happy with the results of this report. I've tracked the corruption all the way to the top. And so keep your ears open. The report will be coming out in the next few weeks. This was mid-June 2003. On July 1, 2003, Inspector General Raymond Lemmy was found dead in a Valdosta, Georgia motel room. He, by the way, he was working down in Tallahassee, Florida. So what he was doing in Georgia, we don't know. The police ruled it a suicide. And I asked Clint at the time that he first told me about this, well, what the heck was Lemmy doing in Georgia? Valdosta is like the first sort of major town across the Georgia border. He
right.
said, well, in Georgia, there's no mandatory autopsy laws. Had he committed suicide in Florida, there would have been a mandatory autopsy. But because he committed suicide in Georgia, there was no autopsy necessary. And, in fact, Ray Lemmy was cremated without a... proper medical forensic examination and no autopsy. So the police report rules it a suicide, says that they took photographs of the crime scene, but due to a, quote, failure in the camera's flash memory cards, there would be no photographs from the scene. Well, guess what we posted about a month ago at breadblog.com?
The scene photos?
The scene photos, the crime scene photos that didn't exist. Unfortunately, the shots of Ray Lemmy in the bathtub. And unfortunately, there's loads of information in those photographs and in the police report that just don't sync up at all.
Any reference to, say, the FBI, Homeland Security... any of those, any interest out of them?
Not that I know of. And now Curtis has been yelling and screaming about all of this stuff.
Who gave the cremation order?
I presume it was the family. I've spoken with some members of the family. There's a difference of opinion about whether this was a suicide or not. I believe at the time, though, they had no idea what Lemmy might have been working on. However, his wife, Marianne, says in the police report that he had been under a lot of stress because he had been working on a big case. I've recently had another witness who knew Lemmy come forward to me, and I have yet to report it yet, who said that she was told the same thing by Raymond Lemmy, that he was in the middle of a, quote, big case. Now, you know, I don't know what we can make of all of that, other than, you know, you have to wonder why all of these discrepancies, why they said there was no photographs, and then in fact there were, and the Valdosta police has since confirmed that, of course, the photographs are legitimate, why there are things that don't match in the photograph, why Ray Lemmy writes a suicide note that was one of these sort of generic notes, you know, I love my family, I'm depressed, I can't take it anymore, I love you, Marianne, and then he doesn't even sign the note, much less he had one daughter who was about to be married in 2 months. And everybody that I've spoken to about it said that, you know, all he did was talk about his he had only one child, she was a daughter, talked about her getting married in September. He doesn't even bother to mention her by name in the note. There's all kinds of other discrepancies. There's a check-in receipt for June 29th, when in fact Ray Lemmy was actually in Tallahassee. So what the heck
he was doing, how he could be in Valdosta,
Georgia, checking into this motel room is a mystery.
He checked into the motel when
fact,
he wasn't there.
The Georgia police, I'm sorry?
He checked into the motel room when he was in Tallahassee.
Correct, yeah. And in fact, the police, Valdosta police confirmed, in fact, that last December, they reopened the Raymond Lemmy case due to, quote, interest on the Internet. They then spoke, as they told me, with someone at the Florida Department of Transportation and closed the case shortly thereafter. They won't tell me who they talked to. As a matter of fact, they won't talk to me at all anymore.
Beautiful.
Has
anyone, you or anyone else, made any efforts toward, for instance, FOIAing the Florida DOT?
Well, yeah. Actually, you can get some of that information. You don't even need to file a FOIA. They have a very good sunshine law in Florida where pretty much all you got to do is call a public agency and say, I am making a public records request for such and such, and they have to give it to you. So that's been one of the reasons it's been, I don't want to say easy, but it's made reporting on this case a little bit easier because it's fairly easy to get at a lot of this hard documentation to see it for yourself.
Well, I'm wondering about the big case, and, you know, it goes all the way to the top. You know, was there a Wang file or a Yang file, rather?
Yeah, there was that report that Lemmy was working on that, in fact, came out in February of 2005. Mind you, it was filed originally. It was began by Lemmy in May of 2001, so it took about 4 or 5 years. And as I said, it came out, and it says that Yang overbilled by about anywhere from $300,000 to $800,000, depending on how you look at it. Yang would not let them do a proper audit, so the report was stamped as inconclusive in the end. But it demanded that they repay some $300,000. It confirmed, in fact, what Cliff Curtis had been saying, that an illegal alien had been working at Yang, that he was arrested for spying on the United States of America. So it confirmed all of that. Didn't have anything about the election rigging and the stuff that might, quote-unquote, go all the way to the top. That was not in the report.
Surprise, surprise, surprise.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And one question, and I'm jumping around with you, and I know you're tired, and I apologize.
Sure.
Going back to the vote-flipping program,
yeah.
Has any comparison ever been made with the results of the South Florida balloting as compared with the way that Clint Curtis describes the way the vote-flipping would work? Is that a sensible question? Do you understand what I'm getting at?
I think I do, and, yeah, I have not been able to go through and sort of do a precinct-by-precinct check of this because, in fact, you know, the program that he was working on would have, I think, flipped it at the precinct level. I do know that the numbers, both in Florida and then, as we've seen recently, in Ohio, were very similar to that 51 to 49% result that Curtis has, you know, that he had programmed into his prototype. But, you know, again, mind you, we don't know what came of that software. We don't know if it was ever used.
Right.
All we know is that Curtis has alleged that essentially Tom Feeney and Yang conspired to create a election fraud software.
Was this, just out of curiosity, was this on an ES&S machine or a Diebold, or do we know which?
No, well, no, we don't know any of that because, in fact, the program that Curtis made was simply a prototype. It was created in Visual Basic, which is a programming language.
Right.
Now, I know that Diebold actually uses a similar software, Microsoft software, that VB script, Visual Basic script, would have worked quite nicely in. They use simple Windows Access database software on their highly complicated voting software that they won't let anybody inspect because it's proprietary. So it well could have been used or something like it, but there's right now there's no way to know. And frankly, we're not getting any help from the media who should be looking into this, who should be investigating it, from the politicians who should be investigating this. Instead, it's just little old me and a bunch of other people who are interested in the story who have been doing digging. And you know, in fact, I'm encouraged, though, because the story is getting out there now. The Miami Herald spoke about it recently in an article on, as you say, election irregularities. They talked about Clint Curtis's claims. The Wisconsin Capital Times, Madison, Wisconsin Capital Times, discussed it. So it's getting out there, but, boy, it's been a long road. I've been at it for 6 months, and Clint Curtis, hell, he's been at it for 4 years. So,
And you guys aren't the only ones hitting the stone wall, though. Congressman John Conyers, I mean, a man of significant prestige on Capitol Hill.
Yep.
This Carter Baker Commission has, for all intents and purposes, slammed the door in his face, have they not?
Yeah, they sure have. I mean, here's the man. His office put out 102 pages of evidence, of sourced, you know, confirmed, footnoted evidence on what went wrong in Ohio in November of 2004. 102 pages of evidence. He was not invited to be on the commission. He was not invited to testify before the commission. His information... the 102 pages of evidence, I don't know if the commission ever had it or not, and frankly, he is hopping mad not about not being included in the commission, but the way this thing seems to have been created in secret, the way the hearings, the first one was yesterday, seemed to turn it all from, you know, election fraud into voter fraud.
Yeah, it's
and
the black
really
people's fault.
Just seems to be a whitewash, and frankly, a whitewash with racist undertones at that. He put out an extraordinary item. I don't know if you caught it last night on the Conyers on conyersblog.us, where, boy, I mean, he really took this commission to task. And he seems to be hopping mad, and my understanding is he's going to try to meet with someone in the commission and see if he can figure out what the heck is going on. He is, yeah, he's the second longest member, serving member of the House.
Yeah.
He's the head of the minority, the ranking member of the minority side of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee. And for him to be completely shut out is remarkable. The commission said, it, when asked why he was shut out, their quote, I think, was, "It's a it was a missed opportunity."
Well, bless my soul.
Yeah.
Just one, and boy, I sure do appreciate the time you spent with us, Brad. Who created the commission? Where what was the enabling legislation? What where was the holy writ from on high?
There was none. There was no legislation. This commission was formed privately. We're still in the process of trying to figure out who the heck created it, who's paying for it, whose idea it was, who decided who would sit on this commission. This whole thing, frankly, stinks to high heaven.
Well, I noticed one story.
Stop by rawstory.com. They had a terrific expose late last week on this commission, on the formation, on the characters that are sitting on this commission and who are testifying before it. It's, you know, once again, they're out ahead, the back ahead of everybody else. And, you know, a lot of times we're just playing catch-up, trying to figure out what the hell these people are doing and how they're getting away with it.
Well, I noticed at one point, Brad, that they tried to hang it on the Carter Center, didn't they?
Well, yeah.
And the
they
Carter
Center. All their materials, and they still say in their materials on the website that this is sponsored in part. I guess Baker has his own center, as well as the Carter Center. Well, when we checked with the Carter Center, they said, no, we don't know anything about this commission. Our work is completely international work only. We don't have a mandate to deal with information in the United States. And as a matter of fact, Carter has recently left the Carter Center. So he's doing this as a private citizen. It has nothing to do with the Carter Center. And yet the commission has run around saying that this is all being done in cooperation with the Carter Center. I mean, you know, they also said that the reason those hearings yesterday, the audience had to be kept separate from the actual commission, was due to Secret Service concerns. Mind you, when we talked to the Secret Service, they said, "Oh, we know nothing about that." So, it's
just
almost too unbelievable.
They just lie.
Yep.
I mean, they just say it, and they expect to be believed, and they repeat it a few times, and then it's truth.
Yep, and the media lets them get away with it.
If
and so
even
you got jerks like me who have to hold them accountable for it somehow.
Well, God bless you for trying, Brad. I'm sincere when I say that. I hope as things progress, of course, I'll report what I see from your blog and try to direct folks to velvetrevolution.us. But I hope maybe you'll update us as things develop. This is, I mean, I remember, and I don't even, frankly, Brad, I don't know your politics, okay?
Right.
And under the circumstances, not being rude, I don't much care. I like what you're doing. I like this search for facts thing means a lot to me, and it's kind of the way we build the program. But I don't know, do you remember the vast number of conspiracy theories that swirled around Bill Clinton and every media outlet in America picked up on it. You had Indiana Congressman Dan Burton shooting watermelons in his backyard to prove that Hillary killed Vince Foster. Do you remember all that?
Yeah, I remember it very well. And as a matter of fact, that was one of the reasons I waited for several months on that Clint Curtis, or I waited for several months before even talking about the Ray Lemmy aspect of it, because I did not want it to end up in that conspiracy theory bin you're talking about, where, you know, all there was a hundreds of people who were killed personally by the hands of Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. You know, this story was too good, and I didn't want it to end up in, you know, to folks to be able to sort of throw it away and throw it into the, you know, the Vince Foster bin. But yeah. When those photographs that didn't exist actually came out, well, I really had no choice to report it. But, yeah, I mean, when it happens on the right, boy, they're all over it. When it happens on the left, the media couldn't be less interested, and I guess that's mythical liberal media you're talking about.
Much more liberal. I don't think we could stand it anymore, do you, Brad?
Yeah, exactly. You got it right.
Brad, thank you so much. This has been a scintillating conversation, very much unlike any I've had on this show, and I mean that in every good way possible. I wish you the absolute best in your endeavors, and you have mine and this audience's admiration for what you do.
Thank you, Bob. Keep holding their feet to the fire, and you know, point them. I do appreciate you pointing them to bradblog.com and velvetrevolution.us, and folks, feel free to donate to the effort at both places, because this really is become more than a 24/7 job for me, and it relies on folks like you to support the effort, because we ain't getting help from the politicians or the big funders out there. We're doing this all on our own, so we do appreciate your support, and please keep making noise.
Thank you, Brad. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Take care. Wow. I don't know about you, but I feel like I've just had an ice cold shot of Aquavit. This is amazing. And you know, no, I think you can tell from the way that Brad delivers his information, this is not something you're going to catch in between aliens abducted my baby and the chupacabras ate my sheep in the middle of the night on George Norrie. This is reality. This is the America you live in. I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat on this particular issue. You ought to give a damn whether or not your vote is counted. Or is that just me being another liberal? No taxation without representation. When in the course of human events, 67 years ago, every single great word that has ever been said in the history of the United States has had as its underpinning the idea of an elected leadership governing by consent of the people. When we cannot trust the ways in which the votes are counted, when we cannot even know for sure if they are counted, the consent of the governed is gone. Give a damn. This is Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid.